From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll look at the Lincoln exhibit at the Indiana State Museum, as well as the upcoming Indiana Art Fair at the State Museum.
I'll hear all about Musical of Musicals, the musical at the Actors Theater of Indiana.
Of Indiana. And I'll get a preview of the upcoming Carmel Gallery Walk, plus we'll have our arts calendar recall.
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. We Hoosiers had a fascination with Abraham Lincoln even before Steven Spielberg's new blockbuster movie, given that the beloved president lived in our state as a boy. The Indiana State Museum, which mounted two popular Lincoln exhibitions in 2010, will open The Lincolns, Five Generations of an American Family, on next Saturday, February 9th. The exhibit contains some very personal artifacts that give clues to the character of the Lincoln family private lives. Sharon Gamble invited Senior Curator of Cultural History, Dale Ogden, and Communications Director, Kathy Moore, to tell us more.
I don't know whether to ask you or not, Dale. I'm sure you've been super busy working to get this exhibition open. Have you had time to watch the Lincoln movie?
Oh, yeah. I think I was one of those guys standing in line for the midnight debut. You know?
And what did you think?
Oh, it's great. It's great. It's great art, in addition to being great history. I mean, Lewis is obviously a genius. I mean, it took me about 10 seconds to stop watching Daniel Day-Lewis and start watching Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
It really is. He's actually channeling the man.
Yeah. Kathy, what did you think?
I have actually not seen it yet, but I know they said that he stays in character throughout the filming of the movie. Even off camera, he stays in character and wanted all his co-workers to call him the president, yeah. Mr.
Right,
president.
Right, and he took a year off. He agreed to do the role, but said, I can't do it on the timetable you want. I need a year to research.
Well, the best thing about it, I think, is the voice, which was kind of startling, I think, for some, for history geeks like me. I thought it was perfect. That was one of the things about Lincoln. In addition to being the giant that everybody knows about, he also had sort of this high-pitched tenor that really had a tendency to throw people off. They expected
a big booming
James Earl Jones, the voice of God,
to come coming out of
out.
Such a tall person.
Yeah,
sure.
And he actually had more of a Kentucky, Indiana twang.
Yeah, kind of a reedy voice.
Very much so.
I read some commentary that suggested that he might have even cultivated those higher registers because his voice would, higher voices are easier to hear than lower voices, especially in crowded situations like giving a speech without a modern microphone, of course,
exactly.
To a crowd. So, yeah. So, you've been so steeped in all of these amazing Lincoln items, and we cannot even possibly do justice to this exhibition, but I have some questions about a few of the exhibition. Talk about the Sum Book.
Yeah, the Sum Book is probably the star of the show. When Abraham Lincoln lived in Indiana, of course, he didn't really have access to textbooks. He couldn't run down to the college bookstore and pick himself up a text, so he made his own. He got a hold of a couple of sheets of paper and just scratched out some arithmetic problems on them and then went back and solved them just to practice his mathematics. There were about 20 pages originally. There are now about 10 that are still known to exist.
Mm-hmm.
It's the oldest document in Lincoln's hand. He was about 14 years old when he started it, and they figure he was about 14, 15 when he was playing around with it. So it's the oldest document in Lincoln's hand, which makes it, of course, unique and a really extraordinary historical artifact.
And the pages got scattered because?
William Herndon, who was Lincoln's law partner in Springfield and also his first biographer of sorts. There are some issues with Mr. Herndon, but he wrote the first extended biography of Lincoln's life. He had the Sum Book, And he just Lincoln had actually sewn it together, and so it formed more of a book. They didn't have paper clips in those days, so
no bulldog binder clips.
Exactly. So Herndon took it apart and then just distributed the individual pages to a variety of Lincoln admirers, pretty much throughout the country. And most of the pages now are in the hands of various institutions. We were able to secure 5 of the 10 pages that are known for the exhibition. The Lilly Library down at Indiana University is supplying a page. The Indiana Historical Society, our friends across the canal, are supplying their page. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, the Chicago Historical Museum, and the Library of Congress are all supplying their pages. So we'll show one side as in its original form and then a facsimile of the verso of that page. So there'll be 10 actual objects on exhibit at all times, 5 originals and 5 facsimiles. Mm. And then in the midpoint of the exhibition, we'll turn the originals over and show the original of the other side.
Cool.
But to my knowledge, I've talked to quite a few people about the Sum book. I'm not sure that any more than 2 or 3 pages have ever been exhibited in the same place at the same time in the history of the book in the last, let's say, almost 200 years.
What a coup.
So, yeah, we're pretty happy with it. I just kept asking people, and they kept saying, that's an interesting proposition, and nobody said no, and we ended up with with, like you say, quite a coup, I think.
What a life lesson there. Yeah. The worst thing that can happen is somebody says no, and actually the worst thing that can happen is you don't even ask, right?
That's it. No. You know, I was pretty obnoxious, I think, in asking for loans for this exhibition, and was generally successful.
Yeah, well, 60 or so times, right?
Your colleagues know that you're charming as well, so those younger folks who are thinking about going into a museum career don't think that you have to put obnoxious at the top of your list.
Yeah, it's all about charm.
That's right. I know you have a lot of skill sets, and handwriting analysis probably isn't one of them, but is there anything about the appearance of the – is it very tidy? Is it? Did he make some comments about how to solve problems that are in words, or is it just numbers? Or?
Well, he actually wrote little poems, little doggerel at the bottom of a couple of the pages.
Cool.
Kind of the period kind of things. Actually, kind of the things that you see, the nicer, friendlier things that you see on bathroom walls on the bottom of a couple of pages. Abraham Lincoln is my name. I write it here for fools to read, that kind of thing.
Oh, my.
There are a couple of little poems on the bottom of a couple of pages that are kind of fun. But mostly it's pretty serious. He taught himself, believe it or not, he taught himself trigonometry. Pretty much just by...
I can't imagine how you would do that.
He borrowed a book and studied the book and just practiced the exercises in the book. And he actually became a surveyor. And as a surveyor, you need geometry and trigonometry. And so he figured if he wanted to be a surveyor, he needed to learn trigonometry and geometry, which he did without the benefit of a teacher.
Man. So we all kind of have this, maybe at least before seeing the new Lincoln film or taking in exhibitions at your place in the past, but we all kind of know that the Lincoln family was pretty down-to-earth, pretty modest folks. So I want to ask about Mary Todd's porcelain figurines.
Modest?
Yeah, the Mary Todd piece, the exhibit being about his family, I think the characters in this play are much richer than I think most people realize.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more to Lincoln's father, for instance, I think, than has traditionally been believed.
For example?
Well, he was a skilled carpenter, an extraordinary carpenter. I would say an artisan. He was actually a community leader. He was a trustee in his church. He was served on juries. He witnessed documents between leading citizens. Tom Lincoln was very well respected. He's not had that reputation, I think, over the last 100 years or so. I think, and this is personal opinion, there's some disagreement about this, but it made Lincoln more of a grand figure if the storyline was that he came out of essentially nothing.
It's a cultivated persona.
It really is.
Is common in today's politics.
And that was, I mentioned William Herndon, and I think Herndon kind of built that that mythology around Lincoln, that Lincoln just sort of appeared out
barefoot
of the woods
kid
one
in the
day
farm.
And saved the nation, and the nation was more than happy to accept that mythology, particularly after the horrific experience of the Civil War. The idea that this man had essentially been, you know, divinely provided to save the nation.
It gave us our innocence back in a way, maybe?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it gave some meaning to the war, to the sacrifice of the war. It was sort of a divinely inspired event in American history. And I think you can take that storyline for what it's worth. I think you can accept a lot of that or dismiss it as you will without really stereotyping his wife, his children, his father.
Sure.
They were all interesting individuals in their own right. And I think providing a little fuller picture of who those people were, I think is not only important, but I think it's just really fascinating as well. You asked about Mary. Everybody kind of, you know, thinks they know crazy old Mary Lincoln, mm-hmm. you know. I think the movie that we had talked about does a pretty good job of presenting her complexity. She was a strong, forceful, aggressive woman. She also had her share of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother died when she was 6. Her stepmother, who brought children into the relationship of her own, made it clear to Mary and her siblings that they were not really valued
yeah.
as much, exactly. She was raised in a large sense by caregivers and tutors and other people, not directly related to her family. But she was also from a very well-to-do family. Her father was one of the richest men west of the Allegheny Mountains. And so she was raised in privilege. Her family owned slaves. She had brothers who fought and died fighting for the Confederacy. It's just a very, very complex story.
You want the Mary Lincoln story to be the next film.
I think Mary in many ways, I think, is one of the most fascinating, tragic, misunderstood, whatever adjective you want to attach to her, figures in American history. 3 of her 4 boys died before reaching adulthood. Her husband, for all intents and purposes, fell dead in her lap. She was in a severe carriage accident, got what we would now know to be a severe concussion. She had migraine headaches. She was treated by doctors who prescribed things like laudanum.
Oh, highly addictive.
Highly addictive, highly narcotic.
And standard procedure at the time.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
So Mary is a very complex figure. The only son that she had that survived had her committed to a mental institution. So that happened in 1875. And what I've been telling people is that you really can't understand Mary Lincoln in 1875 unless you understand Mary Lincoln in 1825. So we try to give a little background of where this woman came from. She also didn't just show up in the White House one day as this, you know, frumpy shrew. She had quite a story of her own. And we try to convey, I think, a little bit of the paradox of Mary Lincoln as well.
And that's what's so fascinating about this sort of exhibition with these unusual objects. I remember the last exhibition and getting to see some of the just day-to-day items that seem so modest but help flesh out that story? Because, of course, even today's history textbooks only have so much space they can devote to each, you know, chapter of history, and so they kind of rely on the broad outlines. But these sorts of objects and items and artifacts help us go behind the scenes and get to know how, get a taste of how complex the people are.
Well, history is about people. You know, history, a lot of people say, I don't like history. I hated memorizing dates. You know, I never liked history. I hated memorizing, you know, battles or whatever. That's not really what history is. History is the story of real people. I always loved history because it was things that really happened. It wasn't a made-up story. When you read history, you were reading actual things that actual people did.
Sure.
And with an exhibition, I mean, as a historian working on this exhibition, and you're holding a toy that Tad Lincoln played with while he was living in the White House, you know, if that doesn't do something to you as a curator and a historian, you really need to think about maybe, I don't know, Walmart
changing
or something else. Yeah. It really is compelling from my point of view.
And I can't imagine a more abrupt change of gears, Kathy, except I want to mention that maybe while folks are seeing this exhibition, they might also want to pop over to the Indiana Art Fair. I can't believe it's the 10th year already. Some of those objects are going to end up in the hands of people who will be making history that Dale will be curating in 10, 20, 40 years from now.
My successor.
Yeah.
The art fair is the weekend of February 15th. We do have a Friday night reception this year, and if you go to that, then you can also go to the art fair for free again on Saturday if you want to do that. But, of course, you can see the Lincoln exhibit while you're there. We also have the signed copies of the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment on exhibit for people to see. We wanted those to be there through January for Martin Luther King Day and things like that. So those are actually up before the exhibit opens on February 9th. And Art Fair James Dean will still be open. So there is a lot going on.
a lot of famous people
and artisans all together at once at the museum.
I really like the idea of James Dean and Abraham Lincoln being in companion galleries.
You know, there is never a dull moment at the museum. We also have Fred the Mastodon that just was erected in one of our galleries. So James and Abe.
If only Steve Allen were still here to do Meeting of Minds, that great old public television show where people from different eras met.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana State Museum Senior Curator of Cultural History Dale Ogden and Communications Director Kathy Moore. You can visit the Lincolns, Five Generations of an American Family, from February 9th through April 13th. Learn more about the exhibit and the Indiana Art Fair at indianamuseum.org. Again, indianamuseum.org. LincolnCollection.org has a treasure trove of information about the Lincoln Financial Foundation collection, the source of the core objects that Dale described in the exhibition. Again, that's LincolnCollection.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Actors Theater of Indiana is producing a musical titled The Musical of Musicals, The Musical, through February 24th at the Carmel Home. Travis DeNicola spoke with actor Cindy Collins and Don Farrell and director Richard Roberts to find out more.
Cindy, Richard, Don, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Thanks. So, a new year and a whole new lineup of great theater up in Carmel that you guys are bringing us. And the musical of musicals, The Musical. It's fun to say the title. I'm sure you guys enjoy just saying it over and over again. How can you not, right?
It's a nice tongue twister.
If you say it once, you've said it over and over.
Five musicals for the price of one, right? So, it's a musical review of musicals? What is this? I know nothing about this. I'm here to learn and listen.
Go ahead, Richard.
It's a show. You know the old story, you must pay the rent. Mm. I can't pay the rent. Well, they've taken that story and they've written five little mini musicals with that as the plot.
Okay.
And each of them is in the style of a different musical theater Broadway giant.
Oh, so fun.
There's a Rodgers and Hammerstein version that's called Corn. That takes place in Kansas in August and has a couple of cowboys fighting over a farm girl.
Okay. Then wow, that sounds so familiar. Anyway.
Exactly. Then there's a Stephen Sondheim version that's called A Little Complex. Okay. It's about a group of neurotic New Yorkers in an apartment building who are stalked by their landlord slash artist slash serial killer.
Okay.
Then there's Dear Abby, which is in the style of Jerry Herman.
And Jerry Herman
wrote Mame and Hello Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh.
So it's a big, jolly, lots of dance tunes, very happy, fun version.
Feathers?
I'm thinking feathers.
There's got to be feathers.
There will be feathers.
Yes.
I can guarantee that. There's an Andrew Lloyd Webber version called Aspects of Junita.
Okay.
About a very imperious, self-important diva and the phantom opera composer who helps her.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And then what's the last one? Speakeasy.
Then Speakeasy. Yeah.
Which takes place in a cabaret in Chicago.
Okay.
In the style of Candor and Never.
Yes.
It's really a brilliantly crafted piece. It parodies all of the musical theater genre. They put in, just using like the Oklahoma section as an example, they put in whether it's the character, the archetypes that they have, where you've got your hero, you've got your villain, you've got your ingenue, and you've got your best friend. But also, not only the way the lyrics are crafted, the lines, but even the musically, it can be like a two-bar phrase that immediately you draws to mind a certain song that's so popular by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Same thing with the other giants that they parody too.
It's insanely clever and very, very funny.
It sounds like it's really funny for you guys to perform and direct and put on. I mean, I'm just guessing. I mean, you must be having a blast with this.
I have never laughed so much in rehearsal. We were talking about this at rehearsal the other day and saying, you know, we're really going to have to work hard to not crack up.
To play it straight.
It's going to be kind of like a Carol Burnett show.
Right. But the beauty of it is playing it straight, of course, and just committing to the material, which is very, very good. And a matter of fact, Joanne Bogart and Eric Rockwell are the two people that wrote this show, and they were just two actors from New York.
When did this come out?
Oh, gosh.
Has it been out for a while?
I saw it 8 years ago. They started writing it about 10 years ago.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, people who love the theater and are lovingly poking fun at
it—it's done with great love and great affection. People who love musicals will see so many things they recognize and really enjoy it. People who hate musicals will also enjoy it because it really pokes fun at all the things that people hate about musicals.
It does.
I don't understand why people hate musicals, but I understand there are people who do.
I've heard that. So the five pieces. Now, is this done with any intermission? Is this done?
There is an intermission, yes.
There's an intermission that's less than 2 hours. They're short.
And Dawn, Cindy, are you in all of them, or how does this work?
It's a cast of four.
Mm-hmm. It is a cast of four. Okay.
It's a cast of four, and each vignette, you have almost the same name. June is my character, so it's June, Junie Fay, Junita, you know, Junie, you know, Don's Jitter, Judder, it's we all play those same kind of characters in each one. We stay with the, you know, the kind of character, the character man, the character woman, the leading man, the ingenue, in each one.
Are there any other references back and forth between each one? I mean, other than that you've got the same actors and similar names, but there's no, like, okay.
There are some lines that happen in each
similar, maybe, that
mean something a little different in each one, which is funny. After a while, you begin to recognize, they said that in
the last one. That's right.
Okay.
Things like that. But each one has something thrown in from every musical that person wrote. So it's a real smorgasbord.
So, okay, out of the five, which for each of you has been the hardest one to nail?
Oh, well.
Don?
Go ahead.
Well, all of you are just like, nuts, so you're obviously thinking
it's very true to its style. So, you know, the Rodgers and Hammerstein comes a little bit easier for my character.
But when you get into the Sondheim section,
holy cow. And you were sharing. Richard was sharing in rehearsal. The when the end was it. You or Brent? Brent Marty is our, first of all, we have an amazing, amazing creative team. That's, we have Richard from IRT who is coming to direct this production.
Okay.
He's a fabulous director.
Oh, shucks.
I hope you don't mind me saying this, Richard.
I'll stand it.
He's okay.
And then we've got Michael Wurzel, who's studied and danced with greats like Bob Fosse, who's choreographing.
Choreography's got to be in the same style,
exactly.
too.
Exactly, and he's very true to the style, whether it's Michael Bennett or whether it's Bob Fosse or Agnes DeMille. Mm-hmm. It's all true to the style. So we have an amazing choreographer. We have Brent Marty as our music director,
who's
also a pianist, and he's amazing. And he's from Civic, and he's amazingly talented. So we're pulling together all these great artistic minds, and we're having just the best time.
But that being said, Sondheim.
Sondheim
is got to be.
It's tough. It's tough.
Yeah.
There's a lot of words.
There's a lot of words in Sondheim, but the Andrew Lloyd Webber is the toughest for me.
Is it?
Because it's pop. Right? It's pop, and I am not a pop singer, you know? So so that style is, you know, and just the, the way he wrote these, you know, all of a sudden this, the notes are so whacked out to me. Some of them just coming out of nowhere. This is just me and my brain, you know.
I suspect
just,
everyone you would talk to would have a different opinion.
Sure.
Which one's the hardest.
Yeah.
How about you, Richard? I mean, as far as just wrapping your mind around it as a director, I mean, you must be going in, at least five different places at once.
It's so much fun, honestly, because it's like, you know, because I love doing musicals and I don't get to do them nearly often enough. And so to get to do five of them at once, is I just am having a ball. And watching them do this, I just sit there and smile. I'm really, really having a good time.
Good, good, good. Well, it sounds like you're all having a fun time. Definitely a good show. Hey, for those, you know, listeners who may not be completely familiar with Actors Theater of Indiana, catch me up on what else you guys do, because this is part of your entire season, Don.
It is, yeah. This is our second season at the Center for the Performing Arts. We present at the Studio Theater, a beautiful, intimate space. It's one of the most unique venues, really, in Central Indiana, and all of our patrons walk away loving it so much because it's a truly unique experience.
Great sight lines, really nice.
Not a bad
right up
seat
close.
In the house,
no.
And you feel like you're really a part of the show, which is really great. It's kind of like IRT's upper stage, but shrunk down.
Yeah,
it's very intimate.
Yeah.
Everyone's very close to the stage, and you do, like you said, you feel like you're part of the show.
Yeah, we get that a lot, that comment a lot. I really felt like I was part of the action, part of the show. I really felt. You feel that energy off the actors, which is what live theater is all about anyway, feeling the energy off the audience and the audience feeling the energy off the actor. And it's, you know, to me, when I walked in there and saw it, it was like a nice little off-Broadway, the newer off-Broadway houses.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it reminded
me of. It's absolutely great space.
And so we started our second season there. We've been here since 2005 when we incorporated, but we started with Gypsy, a great landmark musical with Gypsy. We started our season off. Then we had Route 66, which is a trip across that wonderful, iconic roadway, and had a great time with Route 66. And now we're doing the musical. And that's a great time. And then we're going to be finishing up our season with My Way, a musical tribute to Frank Sinatra. And
nice.
That's going to be May 10th through June 9th. And, of course, Musical of Musicals, the musical, runs February 1st through the 24th.
Very good. Now, you guys, you are a professional theater, a not-for-profit theater as well.
We're a professional equity theater.
And so you rely on sponsorships and donations as well?
Very much so.
And people can always support you, volunteering, donating, things like that, as well as coming to the shows.
That's right. We're looking to expand our Actors Theater of Indiana family and welcome everybody to come join us. It's a great time. We guarantee it's going to be a lot of fun for everybody. And we're having a blast. We like to share it with everybody else.
Well, real quick, I asked you all what was the most difficult, but I'm going to ask you each, what's your favorite moment of the show? And let's start with Cindy.
You know, it's funny. My favorite moment of the show may not be my moment, you know, because I'm with three other people on stage. So, so I get a kick out of, you know, what they're doing too, and songs that they're singing, and I happen to sing. I happen to think one of the best songs in the show is something that I'm not singing. Actually, it's what Judy Fitzgerald is singing. She's one of the other co-founders, and she's in. It's in the, I'm not going to give it away, but it's in the Candor and Ebb section.
Okay.
But that is, to me, I think that's the best song in the show. It's called An Easy Mark, and
So this one's in the style of like Chicago and Cabaret.
It's all like Cabaret Chicago.
Yeah.
that whole Candor and Ebb section happens to be my favorite section because I just love Candor and Ebb, and I love the Fosse style. And you know,
oh, so. It's always so much fun. Don, how about you?
I love it's I know it's so cliche to say, you know, I love them all, but I do love them all. But I get so tickled by the Andrew Lloyd Webber section. It cracks me up. I'm just sitting here laughing just thinking about it. All of the characters. Dave Ruark is the other actor.
Oh, great. Yeah,
Cindy
sure.
mentioned
yeah.
Judy Fitzgerald, who's in the show, right. and Dave Ruark also. And he's great. So it's wonderful. And this is the first
very
time
talented guy.
For him joining us on nice. The ATI stage. So we're thrilled to have him.
That's excellent to hear.
And there's so many. It's I agree with Cindy. There's so many moments I love doing, but I love watching Cindy do certain things and certain things that Dave does and sings. Oh, my gosh. The lyrics are just... They're very, very
Richard,
funny.
It may be unfair to ask you this because it's like, you know, asking them, like, pick Which your favorite,
my favorite
child.
Child yeah. But, well, I'm a huge Sondheim fan, so I really love the Sondheim yeah. section. But like Don said, I really enjoy them all for different reasons. They're all a lot of fun. I think probably my favorite section is actually the section that I had least to do with, which is the finale, which I won't tell you what it is, but it's a big dance number.
Okay.
So I didn't stage it. I don't dance it, but I love watching it.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
And we will let our listeners imagine as well. Guys, thanks so much for coming in to Art of the Matter. Great to see you all.
Thanks for having us.
Travis DiNicola with Actors Theatre of Indiana's Cindy Collins and Don Farrell and director Richard J. Roberts. The musical of musicals, The Musical, runs from February 1st through the 24th. For more information, visit actorstheatreofindiana.org, and they spell theater with an R-E at the end, so actorstheatreofindiana.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
I have it on good authority that winter will only be here just a few more minutes, and we have the calendar items to prove it on our calendar. We call
What'll
We
Do?
Groundhog Weekend Edition.
Nice.
Right.
Very well done. I got to tell you, I am just torn right now about what I'm doing on February 23rd. And it's a good night. It's a Saturday night,
right.
and it's not too long after Valentine's.
Mm-hmm.
It's the night of Dance Kaleidoscope's big annual fundraiser, which I'm really excited about, and that's always a great time. It also happens to be the night that the Children's Museum is going to be open for their Adult Swim.
Yes.
And this is the first time the Children's Museum is going to be turned into a nightclub. It's going to be a 5-story cocktail lounge, everything you want to do at the Children's Museum, plus dancing and games and food and DJs and cash bar and all that stuff, co-produced by Sapphire Theater Company is going to be going. No kids allowed that night. That's going to be fun.
You know what that proves?
Wait, hold on.
Okay.
And that same night is also at Clues, the Masters of Illusion Touring Company. The magicians are coming to town.
I think you're going to have to
There's
magically
a lot that night. I don't know
clone.
What to do, Sharon. But what does that prove? You were
what
talking about the Children's Museum.
What it proves is my colleagues and I in the early 90s at the Children's Museum kept saying we need to have an adults-only night where people can leave their kids with a babysitter.
And come
or
play at
the
Children's
Museum.
Or if
they don't have kids, they can just come and play at the Children's Museum. So see?
Yeah, I think
Put
it's
it
a great
there,
idea.
The universe,
so,
it happens.
I mean, that's just on one night in February.
I don't know what to do.
What else do you have?
Well, if you're listening to us on Thursday night, pay attention as part of First Friday Night. Make sure you make it all the way to the east end of Mass Ave and pop in at Indy Reads, Travis's home away from home. Sorry, Alex, I know Travis is there more than you want him to be. You kick him out, right? No, I'm just kidding. From 6 to 9 on February 1st, this Friday night, it is a preparation for the Alphabet Affair. It's their first ever one-liners competition. Come deliver your best movie lines for a chance to win 2 tickets to the Alphabet Affair. So that's this Friday night, 6 to 9. If you're listening Saturday morning, I hope you were there. Travis, you're not eligible to win, but your best movie line? Can you deliver it for us?
You know, I can't do it right now, Sharon, but come to Indy Reads Books and maybe you'll see me do it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I love that. And we'll tell you more about Alphabet Affair in an upcoming show.
Hey, speaking of bookstores, also want to give a shout out, of course, to Book Mamas, because they have a lot of great readings going on this month as well, including their book club, Shared Pages, is welcoming author Sherry Wood Emmons to lead the discussion of her book, The Sometimes Daughter, and that is coming up on Tuesday, February 12th. Book Mamas has lots of other book club meetings and authors events as well in Irvington.
That's so cool. And if you ask her, Sherry might tell you about her new novel about to be published called The Weight of Small Things.
Ooh, heard it here first.
Just got a review copy of in our mailbox. Hey, you're going to hear more about this with an upcoming interview on The Art of the Matter, but there's a fun new sort of crowdsourcing fundraising program called Power to Give. If you Google power, the numeral 2, and give.org, you'll go there. It's been rolled out across many cities, including recently Indianapolis. Indy Reads, Travis's Other Life, Indiana Landmarks, yep. My Other Life, yep. And WFYI, all on Power to Give.
Make small donations to support really cool things.
Exactly right. So go there and make sure you look up Indy Reads, Indiana Landmarks, and WFYI on Power to Give.
If you hadn't heard it first, well, maybe you're hearing it here first. I am so excited about this, Sharon. My favorite visual artist, my favorite painter is... Can you guess?
Oh, wow, this is tough. You have so many.
I know you collect
Kyle Ragsdale. It's not Kyle, is it?
Well, Kyle is a big favorite of mine, and I'd love to say that I collected this other artist, but I can't really afford Matisse.
Oh.
But I am such a huge fan of Matisse, and I'm so excited that the IMA is going to have a huge Matisse exhibit Matisse Life in Color. They've just announced Masterworks from the Baltimore Museum of Art, and it is opening this fall. Congratulations to the IMA.
And when we get closer, we'll hear an in-depth behind-the-scenes insights to that.
You bet.
I'm guessing Travis is going to do that interview.
I'll see what I can finagle.
Mm-hmm. Let me know if you end up with a Matisse on your wall at home, dear.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week.
Oh, no.
So we will have to come back next week for that calendar we call.
What do we do? Be nice to your groundhog.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The Carmel Art and Design District has experienced exponential growth in its short life. A dozen galleries not only welcome visitors from around the U.S. and beyond, they also participate in Carmel's second Saturday gallery walks. Sharon Gamble invited painter and gallery owner Jerry Points and photographer gallery owner, Carmel Art and Design District Gallery Association President Terry Gentry to our studios to learn more.
Carmel has done this absolutely astonishing growth path. And for the last few years, everybody has kind of focused on the Center for the Performing Arts and the performing arts. But the visual arts have actually grown maybe even faster, right? Terry, I'm looking at you because of your 30,000-foot view over the governing body for visual arts in Carmel.
Well, it has. I mean, we have today 9 galleries, a very diverse group of galleries in the district. It continues to grow, as do other entities within the district. A number of restaurants have opened in the last year to two, and it's a great destination. We consider, you know, that we have one of the best gallery destinations in the Midwest.
So how do you account for that growth?
Well, I think, first of all, the community has been focused on that growth. It's provided some tremendous infrastructure opportunities on Main Street in particular, a revitalization there that just has attracted the type of businesses that we have.
Mm-hmm. And Jerry, you've moved your gallery and studio
right,
as well to
right.
Carmel.
You know, I was down at Stutz for 6 years, mm-hmm. and had a studio gallery there, but other than the open house, there just really weren't that many people going through the Stutz, and as an artist, I just needed more exposure. And so when I looked at the opportunities that were there and working with the city and their support of the visual arts, it was an easy decision for me to move the whole operation to Carmel.
What does that support look like?
Well, the support is pretty much they'll kind of work with you in hearing your business plan, and it varies for every gallery and every business, but for me, the help came in the form of the build-out. And as I looked at some of those expenses, there was a little bit of help there. And it was just enough to make it a real worthwhile type of investment for me to open a gallery, represent not only my work, but 15 other artists.
Sure.
And the same thing seemed to be happening through the district. And It actually started well before some of the other areas that are being built up now, you know, with the arches going up and the mayor's vision. And we've had some galleries come and go, but we have a pretty stable group of nine, as Terry said, very diverse galleries.
And you've just mentioned something very important, too, which is nine galleries doesn't mean nine artists. It means a significantly higher number of artists, because most of those galleries are showing the artwork of their owner. But some of the galleries, the owner may not be an artist, right? Do you have any galleries
Correct.
Where the owner is not
yeah,
an artist?
I'd say about half of our galleries are representing other artists from around the United States. I have two artists from Europe. I know Surrey has, and Evan has.
Magdalena does.
International, yeah. So there's a nice flair to the work that you see. And the other thing that impressed me was the overall price point availability. You can walk in some galleries and spend $50 or $100 and walk away with something that's very unique, or you can spend $5,000 or $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how do you, Terry? How do you ensure enough diversity of styles of art? Do you have? Is there kind of a big picture view of you want to make sure you have this percent abstract painters, this percent sculptors, so on and so forth, or is it maybe not quite as engineering-like as that sounds?
Well, I think as far as the galleries in general, it really is not engineered in that fashion.
Yeah.
I think we are, however, fortunate to have established a very diverse, high-quality set of galleries with, as Jerry mentioned, artists from not only local artists, but regional artists, national artists, international artists. And so I think we're very fortunate from that perspective, the diversity that we present. It's not something that was planned that way. It's just kind of the way it has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
As far as particular galleries, I think Jerry touched on the fact that in some cases the galleries tend to have more artists than others. In the case of mine, you know, it's one or two or three artists in my gallery, but in some cases it's many more than that.
How do you choose your artists?
Well, predominantly in my gallery, it's me.
Well, yeah, that's a no-brainer, right?
But we do
right?
have we do have sculpture as well.
Mm-hmm.
We've had other types of art in the gallery. The predominant gallery in my art is my photography.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, Jerry, how do you choose your artists?
That's been, I think, the most exciting thing about having looking at it as a business, and in addition to just showcasing my work and the idea of bringing in 15 or more artists. Over the two-year period that I've had the gallery, it's really been fun to go out and find artists that kind of fit the mission of the gallery, and that is I try to have excellent art at very affordable prices. And the interesting thing over the 2 years is that I've sort of found out what works and what doesn't work, but I've also had good feedback from people coming in the district from Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, Cincinnati, Columbus, Ohio, and so I've been able to get, you know, a lot of the comments from them about, wow, you're showing some, whether they're buying or not, it's you're really showing a high quality of work. And
mm-hmm.
I like what I'm seeing in the district. It's a fun place to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always surprised when people will just walk in, you know, like from Detroit, saying, we decided to take a day trip, and we've heard a lot about Carmel, and we're here to check it out.
That speaks to the quality of what you're putting out for the public to consume, but also the quality of vision, politically and in terms of media relations, public relations. And
right. We work hard at that through the Gallery Association.
Yeah.
We meet once a month and have a lot of discussions as to how we're going to move things forward and work together. And you don't really see that in other communities. I have some artist friends in other communities around the Indianapolis market, and you don't see gallery associations able to come together and work with the city to promote the visual arts. And that's been the most unique thing, I think, in the decision of going to Carmel.
So if you had to describe what differentiates the Carmel gallery scene from, say, the Broad Ripple gallery scene or the Mass Ave/Downtown gallery scene or the Fountain Square gallery scene, how would you describe what is your brand? your plural.
The main thing, and Terry can certainly come in on this, the main thing I've observed is that obviously we're in a different demographic area than downtown Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. And being a part of the Stutz for 6 years, there's some great art. I'm not knocking the art in downtown
sure.
Indianapolis. There's some great venues there. But it seems to be more on the area of emerging artists. It's a younger group of artists. It's a younger group that are attending the gallery openings. And what I've noticed in Carmel is that whether they're buying or not, a lot of the people that walk in the gallery can't afford to do it. And so I try to have artists in there that are well-established. You know, I like to promote younger artists, but it's a lower percentage. And so my artists have been in other galleries. They've won awards. They're in major collections. And that's the same with many of our galleries. It's more of an established, a little higher level of artist, I think, that you would see in many of the galleries around the community.
Mid-career and be whatever the next phrase is, beyond mid-career.
Right.
Well-established,
right.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah, I also believe that our... Jerry touched on our association.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big factor. Our last meeting we held, we had 8 of the 9 galleries represented.
Wow.
That's good, but that's reasonable. That's what we expect and what we normally see is active participation. And from talking to some of the communities that I've talked to, at least regionally, I think our association is very effective, and that combined with the city and working together, I think it's made a big difference.
Tell me about some of your newest galleries. You've had a lot of openings pretty recently, a lot of new business coming in.
Well, let's see. Yeah, we've had some galleries that have been in the district for a while, very strong in terms of, you know, Evan Lurie's Gallery, Surrey's Gallery, Magdalena Gallery. We have Coates Wright that's moved into the Design Center and have a very unique offering with paintings as well as paintings and sculpture as well as furniture. Being associated with the Design Center, it gives you a little twist of what a gallery can be.
Sure.
So I don't know if you have anything to add to that or not, but
one of the things I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention is the fact that in working with the city and the entire district working together, a number of events during the year have made a big difference. Artimobilia, Art of Wine,
International Art Fair.
International Art Festival.
Mm-hmm.
All of those activities, as well as a number of others that are promoted in the district, have added to this, velocity as we continue to march forward. So. It's a definitely a group effort, a community effort, and it's paying dividends.
I'm curious. You know, you're both working artists who probably never intended to be the administrators that you've just described yourselves being. I mean, running a business can take over your life. Running an association can take over your life. Do you ever think, oh, what am I doing? I need more studio time, or does helping to juggle the needs of, you know, organizing your events, Artimobilia and the art walks and so forth, does that provide a nice chance to get away from the studio and give you a break? How's that
it's
work?
It's a good balance for me. I've since built a studio on my property at home, and I work a lot there rather than work in the gallery. Terry and I both have business backgrounds, and so the juggling and time scheduling that we have to do comes to us, I think, because of our business background. So it's the left brain and the right brain
sure.
working together. So I don't know. I've seemed to have worked that out in the last several years, and I enjoy the aspect of the business where I've talked to a lot of artists that have said, oh, that's not for me, but
don't make
fun.
Me do that. I just want to paint.
Yeah.
I just want to sculpt.
That aspect of yeah. it. Sure.
Terry, you kind of smiled when I asked the question.
I would have to say that there are times when it does seem like it takes time away from maybe what you'd want to be doing from an artistic perspective. I travel a lot with my art, so I'm I'm in national parks. It's not uncommon for me to be on either side of the country, and that takes time. So does it ever seem like it gets in the way a little? I have to be honest and say, yeah, it does, but it's worth it. And the fact that we're part of a gallery association that we're a part of, we're part of a district that is considered premier in the Midwest, it makes it all worthwhile.
Strangest place anybody has ever come from and walked in the doors of your gallery? Most exotic place? Most surprising place? You mentioned people saying, we came down from Detroit for a day trip, and you're like, wow, you've heard of us in Detroit.
Yeah, a lot of regional, but again, I don't know. We just have people from all over the United States. Or in Carmel, it just seems like there are a lot of people coming in from so many different areas, including Europe and South America. Right. They have friends there that are visiting. They're there for tournaments, and they want to get in to see the downtown area. They're coming in for performances. So that's been a nice draw. And I think the city's realized that, you know, build it and they will come type of attitude.
It's part of the economic development of Carmel.
Sure, right. Absolutely.
Sharon Gamble with gallery owners Jerry Points and Terry Gentry of the Carmel Arts and Design District Gallery Association. Jerry is also a painter and Terry is a photographer and the president of the Gallery Association. The gallery walks are 5 to 10 p.m. on the second Saturday of each month. The next walk is February 9th. Be sure to check out the numerous retail outlets that stay open and the restaurant scene as well. Find out more at CarmelArtsAndDesign.com, and that's all spelled out, CarmelArtsAndDesign.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at OwlStudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I chat with author Dan Barton about a new play he's premiering at Butler. And then I'll also get a preview of the Meet the Artist exhibit at the Central Library.
Then I'll host a roundtable discussion with Travis, plus Lloyd Wright, Clayton Taylor, and Jim Simmons about taking The Art of the Matter to public television. That's right, TV. Look out, world. Plus, wow, we'll have our calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.